From the Witherspoon Concert Hall in Omaha's Joslyn Memorial, KIOS-FM proudly presents another program from the Uta Hawley Lecture Series. We'll hear a talk given by nationally acclaimed humorist Hope Mialup. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Monday morning, May 12, 2003, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Uta Hawley Girls Village, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Dennis McCarville, Chief Executive Officer of Uta Hawley Girls Village.
Hope Mialup, and of course I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, is a nationally acclaimed humorist who was born in Virginia and grew up in a Greek-American family. She's a graduate of Vassar College, and she has been a newspaper columnist, a public radio announcer, a character voice for numerous radio and television commercials, and a guest on many television shows. As a humorous speaker, Hope was named top discovery in the field of humor by the International Platform Association and the recipient of the prestigious Mark Twain Award for Humor. In addition, Hope also holds the Council of Peers Award of Excellence from the National Speakers Association, considered the Oscar of the speaker's profession. Hope is married to a professor of Russian, and between the two of them, they speak seven languages. They have three children, one a teacher who seems to have traveled more than any teacher I know, from China to Yemen, one an artist, and the third an actor. Hope and her husband still live in Virginia, where she shares cooking as a favorite form of relaxation, where she shares that with me. That's my favorite form of relaxation, too. My kids, of course, have to suffer through my cooking, too. I don't think they're calling it relaxing these days. Please join me in a warm Greek and Irish and Italian and Hispanic and Native American and Polish and on Omaha welcome to Hope Mialup.
When they were backstage with me now, they were worried to death about how to pronounce my name. And this happens to me all the time. And I remember one time, some poor man was so nervous about it that he called me up in the hotel room and he said, and I'm going to say this exactly the way he said it. He said, "Can you come down here and tell me how to pronounce this dumb name?" So with this friendly welcome ringing in my ears, I went down to the hotel lobby and I said, "Well, we say Mialup." He said, "I can't say that." I said, "Well, do you want to say Mialup? That's all right." He said, "Well, can I say Mialup?" I said, "You can say anything you like, sir." And that night he introduced me. "I'd like to present our speaker, Miss Hope Mishap." Yeah, he did. So he knew what he was talking about. Now, when I was 5 years old, my mother took me to enroll me in kindergarten. And I remember that scene so vividly. The principal of the kindergarten came out. And in my memory, she's like Queen Elizabeth, and I mean the ship. And she said to my mother in a voice just like a ship, she said, "The child has to bring her lunch every day." And so my mother went home and told my father, who was the native-born Greek, "Get Hope a lunchbox." Well, now, all the other children in that kindergarten had those little tin square lunchboxes that you're familiar with. Those days, I believe they had Mickey Mouse on one side, Donald Duck on the other. My father went down to work construction foreman by equipment, and he got one of those giant black lunchboxes that looks like a locomotive, you know the kind? It had two thermos bottles and six compartments in it. And this is what they put in my lunch the next day, five-year-old. One thermos bottle had hot chicken soup in it. The other one had some spaghetti with meat sauce that had been left over from the night before. There was a turkey leg wrapped in wax paper, a salad in a little bowl with a jar of oil and vinegar to pour on at the last minute, a feta cheese sandwich you could smell a block and a half away, a pear, an apple, and a chunk of cake. The lunch weighed 37 pounds. And I hauled it into the kindergarten. And at lunchtime, the entire school came and they stood in this little semicircle and looked at my lunch. And then in unison, they said, the way children do. Well, I was offended by this. And that afternoon, I went home and told my mother about it. And in fact, I cried too. And she said, "Well, honey, what was in their lunch boxes?" I said, "Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches with no crusts." And my mother said, "They're gonna die." And a lot of them are dead now. It does your heart good. Well, even though, you know, I have this Greek background, and I'm sure all of you know how important food is to Greek, because you've seen Big Fat Greek Wedding. And also, as you well know, every single Greek owns a restaurant. I mean, this is just a historical fact here. And nonetheless, I think that things that have happened to me in my life are still things that you can all relate to, because they happen to everybody. And the point is that you have to see the humor of them. And sometimes it takes months or maybe years before you see the humor. But in order to carry you through my life with me so you can see what things you can relate to, I've divided this into three categories today, and they all very nicely start with the letter C. So we have, for example, childhood, career, and children. That's how it goes. You know, that's how my life went, from one thing to the next. Now, as for childhood, of course, that was colored by my ethnic background. And I remember the big intrigue of that was language, which is why I love languages so much, and I love foreign languages. My husband, the introduction, I'm sorry to say, is an old one by mistake, which I didn't alert the Speakers Bureau to. He's my late husband now. He's been gone for a while. But he was Russian. I'm Greek. And we all had language difficulties at home. Mine started when I was a child. I remember translating for all the rest of the family because I could understand what the problem was. My father, for example, we were driving through Washington, D.C. Now, my mother, the Virginia-born Greek, was telling us what to look at, I'd say, as we drove. Anyway, here comes the Capitol. Oh, here's the White House. Oh, look here, Lincoln Memorial. And our heads would swivel from side to side. And all of a sudden, we pulled up next to the Treasury Department. And my mother assumed that it was the Mint. So she said to Daddy, look, Chris, the money mint. My father said, "What monument? We passed the monument 2 blocks ago." Now, I was the only one that got it, you know, and 8 years old, and I sat in the back seat laughing helplessly, and I thought, this is the kind of thing that I have to listen for the rest of my life. Well, sometimes I was around when these things happened, sometimes not. For example, in Virginia, we had this lovely old Greek lady named Mrs. Yamalaki, and one time she said, "English is a stupid language." And her daughter, who was my friend, said, "What do you mean, Mama?" She said, "You have 5 different things, and you use the same word for everything." She said, "No, we don't." "Yes, you do. Look, you wear beets on your neck. You eat beets in a salad, all right? You go swimming in the beets. If you don't want so much, you say, 'Give me little beets.' If you don't like somebody, he's a sonamu beets." True, I'm not kidding, true. This means that when things like this happen, people know that I love it, and they call me up and tell me. And this I heard about one of these classes we give in town for immigrants. They all, no matter what country they're from, they go to the local high school and take an evening class to learn how to speak English. And apparently this happened. The teacher said, "Ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're going to compose sentences using 3 English words. And those words are green, yellow, and pink. Who would like to go first?" And the Frenchman raised his hand. He said, "I make a green salad. I put on yellow mayonnaise. And then I eat a pink strawberry." She said, "Very good." Then the Greek raised his hand. She said, "Yes." He said, "The telephone rings. Green, green." I pick it up. I say, yellow. Is nobody there? Pink, I put it down. Well, then, with all these language intrigues being Greek, I then married a Russian. And that added a whole new level to the misunderstandings that could go on. He and my mother could not understand one another. I remember one time we were frying fish fillets, he and I, those little narrow fish fillets, like perch or whatever. And my mother came into the kitchen and she saw what was in the pan and she assumed that it looked like shad roe to her. So she said to my husband, is that roe? He said, no, it's cooked. No. The best things of all happened to my husband when he first came to the United States. And I didn't know him then, but he told me about these wonderful things. First of all, guess where he learned English, ladies and gentlemen? Fort Bragg, North Carolina. This is not the best place to learn English. Not because it's North Carolina, but because it's an army base. So he learned a lot of his language from the soldiers, which means that these are stories limited to be told in public. But my favorite one was this. He was lonesome. He had left the Soviet Union during World War II. He didn't know if his family was living or not. He assumed he was entirely alone. And so there he was, bless his heart, lonesome in the barracks. And one soldier said to him one night, hey, Mac, come here. We're going to fix you up with a blind date. Well, he looked up blind in the dictionary. Why blind, he said. Oh, you're going to have fun with her. How could they joke about something this serious, he thought. So when he met the girl, he kept looking into her eyes. She thought it was romance. And he couldn't understand why she could see, but he was delighted. And he took her out that evening. And when he took her home that night, he said, could we go out again tomorrow night? She said, oh, I'm sorry. I can't go out tomorrow night. We're giving my girlfriend a shower. He looked that up in the dictionary. He said, who is giving her a shower? He says, oh, about 50 of us. God, he said, why? He said, well, she's getting married. So he thought we'd purify the brides in a ritual. Now, these mostly early language memories are my favorite part of that was not childhood, but it goes with the language problems. One thing I do remember about childhood is interesting things that happen to do with food, as always, like the kindergarten experience. Another one was a story that came down to me, even though it had happened long before I was born, and this involved my grandmother. My grandmother came to the United States in 1900, and she was the first woman from Greece to settle in that entire area. Now, this meant two things. Number one, she could not talk to anyone in the United States except her husband, because he was the only other Greek around. So she couldn't learn English very quickly, just wasn't her thing, and she kept talking Greek. Number two, since she couldn't speak English, she couldn't invite people over to serve them food. Now, you don't know what a deprivation this is for a Greek woman. She had been brought up to cook and serve people food. And so she bided her time. She had six children in desperation. She figured, I can feed them. And then finally one day, her opportunity came to serve food to a stranger, because that was the goal. You bring out all your best food for strangers, and then they say, oh, this is beautiful. I mean, that's how she was brought up. Well, it happened that one of her children had a fight in the second grade. That was my Aunt Connie. We say aunt in Virginia, you know. And she came running home from school, and she said, the teacher is coming to see you at 4:30. In Greek, of course, she said that. My grandmother went berserk. Here was a chance for her to serve food to a stranger. Well, she didn't have a lot of time. She threw a pan of baklava into the oven. She brought a ham out of the refrigerator and sliced it all. She had a cheese in the garage, a wheel, and she rolled it into the house. cut up about half of it, put bread on to rise, ground coffee beans, and then she prepared the first serving. Because in these kinds of Greek homes, you get the big food after a while. The first food is generally preserves, the best preserves you have. You know, you get those preserves homemade almost always, and you fill. Whose telephone is that? Now, did I bring mine up here? No, I didn't. It's not my telephone. That's all right. When you answer it, say yellow. In any case, my grandmother had preserves that had come with her from Greece. And what these were something you couldn't get in the United States. Preserve green walnuts. Now, let me explain that. You cut the walnuts off the trees before they get hard. They're still soft. And you preserve them in a very rich, thick, powerful syrup. One of those walnuts can last 2 weeks after you eat it. Well, being Greek and wanting to show off, even though just one teacher was coming, naturally, you filled the bowl. And she put about 25 walnuts in there, put a fork for the teacher to use, and then a glass of ice water, which you're supposed to drink after you eat the walnut. And then in the back of the tray went 8 little glasses. And in these went the homemade alcoholic beverages of the household. Now, the idea of such a tray is this. When it goes around the room, you pick up your fork, you spear a walnut, eat it over your water, and then select your drink. And then it continues around to the other guests. Even if no other guests are there, you fill the bowl. And out came the tray. Now, when the teacher first came in the door, my grandmother said, "Sit down," because she knew a few words in English. And the teacher sat by the door with her hat and coat still on. My grandmother picked up the tray, brought it over, shoved it under the teacher's chin, and said, "Eat." And the teacher said, "Well, I don't know if I can eat all this, but I certainly will try." And of course, she picked up the bowl and ate all 24 of the preserved green walnuts. But you could hear them hitting as they went down. Bam! After she had finished them all, she was woozy. And so she drank the ice water, and then she saw the little glasses. "Well, now, what's in all these little glasses?" Down went the ouzo, then the 7-star brandy, then the wild cherry wine, the pear schnapps, the peach cordial. After the 8th one, she forgot why she'd come to the house. And my grandmother formed her opinion of American educators that day. "Bunch of drunks coming here with everything in the house." And nothing we said would ever change her mind, you see. Well, these are memories of my childhood. Then I moved on to the next C in the category, which is career. Of course, I had to go to college first to get there. And I must explain something funny about that. Growing up in Norfolk, Virginia, of course, I had a Southern accent. But I wanted to go north to college because I had only heard Southerners my entire life. And I wanted to hear what it sounds like to hear people who are not radio announcers. Because, you see, we didn't have TV yet. We hadn't heard accents the way you hear on Wheel of Fortune and things like that, you know. We Southerners had never heard the letter R pronounced. So when people say on Wheel of Fortune, "I'd like an R, Pat," that knock us out. You know, we never heard an R pronounced. And so there I was wanting to go north, and the Southerners could not believe it. They said, "I cannot imagine why you want to leave a lovely state like Virginia and go up yonder to some godforsaken place. Where is it again?" I said, "Poughkeepsie, New York." "I cannot imagine." "Well, go on if you want to." And I always thought of saying, "The war is over. You know, I think it's all right to go north now." In any case, when I went up there, there were no more than 3 of us in the freshman class who were from the South. So that when we spoke, things ground to a halt. People jumped around and, listen to this. And we got very self-conscious about it. I remember in English class, the professor came in. He was a young PhD. He made an opening remark that even he didn't understand. This is not unusual in the academic world, I can assure you. And after he had made this statement, he looked around the room and he said, "Can anyone comment on that?" And a girl raised her hand. She said, "Sir,
I think the matter you have brought up deserves careful consideration so that in going to the sources you have delineated, we can reach the necessary conclusions that are inherent in a matter of this magnitude and thereafter come laterally to the deductions that you have provoked by this discussion. And then he looked at me. He said, "Do you agree with that?" I said, "Yes, sir, I do." Who sounded smarter? So in any case, I managed to survive college in spite of this, and then the career began. Now, there was a reason why I had a so-called career, and it was very simple back in the mid-50s. No one had asked to marry me yet. We went to college to find husbands, among other things, and no one had asked me. In fact, I remember, and maybe you of that my same era will remember, what we used to call the Sunday morning diamond ring syndrome. This meant that senior year, girls who had gotten their diamond engagement rings on Saturday night came down to breakfast in the dormitory and reached for the cream like that. And when that diamond would reflect the ceiling lights, everyone would scream and fall out of her chair and foaming at the mouth, "She got her ring!" And I said to them at the time, I said, "Girls, listen to me. If ever I happen to get engaged, I don't want a diamond engagement ring." "What do you mean?" I said, "No, no, really." I said, "From what I can tell, what we're going through right now, the only reason for the diamond engagement ring is to torture other women. It doesn't mean you're married yet. The gold band will tell us that. No, this ring exists only to torture one another. Why do we want to do this to ourselves?" Well, fate, 9 years later, hurled me into the arms of a professor who was too poor to buy me a diamond ring. Do you see how God punishes you when you make these statements? The truth about the ring, though, is this. I had meant it. I really didn't care about getting the diamond ring. But other women minded it. Women I barely knew. They would come out of the woodwork and they would say, "Why hasn't he gotten you your ring yet?" I would say, "He can't afford it." "Oh, yes, he can. You get out there and make him get you that ring." Well, I didn't tell the poor man a single thing, but someone must have told him, and he was very ill at ease. And one night, about 2 weeks before we got married, we were having dinner together and having those veal cutlets or chops that have round bones in them. And like any good European, he ate all around the bone, ate the marrow out of the middle too. And then he said, "I think this bone would fit your finger." Perfect fit. He said, Take this bone to work. Tell the women I have finally bought you a ring. Ah, they will laugh." Now, I know women a lot better than he does. But I didn't want to spoil his fun, so I washed the veal bone and Ajaxed it. And then I put it in a delicate little jewelry box, and I took it with me to work. I was working at the newspaper office then. I waited until there was a lull, and I said, "Girls, Larry gave me my ring last night." Well, it was just like the dormitory. Women screamed. A big woman fell off a chair and hurt herself. You know, the elevator came down bulging with screaming women from another floor. I don't know how they heard so fast. And they all said, "Why aren't you wearing your ring?" I said, "Because I want you all to feel the same thrill I felt when I opened the jewelry box and saw it." Nobody laughed but me either. Well, in any case, that, as I said, that business led me into a career. Now, I worked at the Metropolitan Opera for 4 years, and that's simply because I'm an opera lover. You don't go looking for a job in an opera house unless you happen to like opera, which I do for some reason, and loved it. I loved it. I was the secretary to Rudolph Bing, and we had a wonderful time that I scared to death of him, I don't mind telling you, but I was around opera all the time, which was exactly what I had wanted. Now, one interesting thing about opera lovers is this. We like it when things go wrong on the stage. We really do. We like to hear things go right, but if something physically goes wrong, like a chair collapsing under a heavy singer or a piece of scenery going over into the pit and hitting the conductor, to us, these are good evenings. You know, we can tell people about this. So in my years at the Met, I heard and saw many fine such things. There was the night, for example, when a famous tenor was making his debut, and he was singing in La Traviata. And in the end of the opera, as many of you know, poor Violetta dies, and he sobs and falls at the foot of her bed. Well, the stage director had a great idea. He said, listen, no. Instead of having her die in the bed, what we'll do is have her jump out of the bed, because she is, after all, saying that she feels better. She'll jump out of the bed, come running over to you. You hold your arms open. She'll come into your embrace. You hold her tight, and then she'll die. This is very gripping. He said, then I want you to open your arms, and she'll fall out of your embrace onto the bed. Fine, he said. That's very, very shocking. That'll please the audience. Well, that night she had on a gown with a lot of lace, and he had on a suit with a double row of brass buttons. He buttoned himself into her dress. And so when she fell, he went with her. Blam! On the couch. Another wonderful one, and this is now a legendary story, is that there was a soprano singing Tosca. And in the end of Tosca, poor old Tosca, having killed the police chief, climbs up to the top of the highest building in Rome and jumps off it to her death. Now, naturally, you don't see her land, of course. She lands behind the scenery on a stack of mattresses. But because she was not a very pleasant woman, the stagehands discussed her upcoming death. One of them said, give me $5 and I won't put no mattresses back there tonight. And the other man said, we can't do that. She might kill herself. He said, well, let's think about it. Well, they thought about it and they came up with a far more interesting idea. They put a trampoline behind the scenery. She came up 6 times after the suicide. And you know what? I heard that Maria Callas, too, had problems with that role, that in the second act she's supposed to stab the police chief to death, and there's supposed to be a little, a little knife on the table there. Well, the stagehands, for some reason, had taken away that knife. And in the few moments before she's supposed to stab him, she's supposed to look down, see the knife, grab it, and hold it behind her back. She looked down. There was no knife. She thought, well, what am I going to kill him with? And it was too late even to think about it much longer. So she reached behind her and took one thing she could find. He came her, and she stabbed him with a banana. These are all wonderful things that happen at the opera. There's no reason not to be an opera lover. You see what I mean? Another aspect of my career days was simply living in New York City. Now, this was a revelation to me again, because you see, I had grown up in the South, and then I went to a college and was closeted there on the campus, and now here I was in one of the biggest, most turmoilish cities in the world, and that delighted me for various reasons. I got to hear New Yorkers speak, and this was a whole new world to me, you see, because as I said, we didn't have TV yet, so I had not heard real New York accents in person. What interested me a lot was shopping in New York City, because the contrast between shopping in New York and shopping in Virginia was enormous. I would recommend that if ever you were to go shopping in New York, you avoid buying underwear. Now, that's because underwear is a rather nerve-wracking thing to buy. Unlike men who go into Sears and buy a package of underwear and leave, we women have to go try on underwear, and that's where the problems could begin in New York. For example, a saleswoman might see you getting off the elevator and begin to humiliate you before you even get to the booth. Miss, coming in over there, what do you want? You want a girdle, a girdle. She wants a girdle, Francis. Now, at this remark, the other 200 customers look at you from the rear as you come across the room. What size girdle did you have in mind? Medium. Is this for you? Francis, I got a wannabe over here.
What color large did you want?
What do you mean white, of course? You always wear a white girdle, huh? It's your favorite color, white. You choose white above all other girdles. Just let me show you this. This is a magenta purple rose. Little flowers in the crotch. Look, is this beautiful? Is this beautiful? What, are you embarrassed by the color? You have an accident, they take you to the emergency room. Wouldn't the interns be thrilled? You know what I mean? It's something a little different here. Okay. Now let's try it on. Remove your previous foundation, please. Is this the girdle you've been wearing? Francis, come here. All right, here's what we're going to do now. I'm going to count to three. You hold your breath. We'll pull up the girdle together. Take it easy. One, two, three. And you wanted a medium, huh? Yeah. Francis, come here. Let's try it again. One, two, three. All right, start walking and don't stop. Start walking and don't stop. If you stop, you're in trouble, okay? Very nice. I want to see how it does. Would you lift up your skirt? Well, how can I see the girdle if your skirt covers it, right? Right. I keep it lifted just like that. Keep it lifted up. Mr. Williams, would you come here a minute, please? Now, honestly, this scared me to death, you know? I would do anything to avoid buying underwear in New York City until I could get back to Virginia, because I wasn't afraid of the saleswoman there. But when I did go back home, after having worked in New York City, I realized that the Southern saleswomen, in their own way, were just as terrifying as the ones in New York. The difference was they come on very pleasantly at first, and then they consume you in a strange way. There, they're too familiar. They say, would you look who's coming in here? Darling, we have been talking about you. Haven't we been talking about her? Come on in here and let me hug you. Honey, you are looking stunning. Listen, I have someone that came in here. We thought about you. Bring that dress when we thought about her. Darling, I want you to try this on. I'm not going to sleep if you don't wear this out of here. I'm not going to sleep. Now, come on in here. Let's put this on you. Now, hold your breath. It's not too tight. Go stand over there and let me look at you. Oh, that's you, darling. That's you. Yeah, isn't this her? Isn't this her? That's you. You're going to wear it out of here. I'm not going to sleep if you don't wear that out of here. No, it's not too short. No, darling, I have been up to New York and I have seen miniskirts. That's not too short for you. Of course, you will have to get shorter underpants, honey. But it's stunning on you. Well, after working in New York City, I came back to Virginia, and I still wasn't married. You know, the ring had not appeared, and so I had to get another job. I got one at the newspaper office. That was the most fun place to work because it had certain aspects of the opera house in it, in that the mistakes made at the newspaper lived on into eternity in print. Those were the days before word processors. And so we made terrible mistakes sometimes in the typing, and we'd put our papers into little pneumatic tubes and send them to the back, and there the people who set it into print, I'm sure, purposely made mistakes just to torment us. The best mistakes were always in what we then called the society page, where weddings were described, you know. And I remember reading some of these marvelous things. One of them was, the bride's only ornament was a string of pears. There was, the bridegroom's mother wore a gown that fell to the floor. At the reception, ladies poured at both ends. I saw these in print. My favorite thing of all, and I still have the clipping, I've saved it all these years, we printed a photograph of three prominent club women. And in those days, too, they wore big flowered hats. They had these great big hats on, and one was presenting a check to the other as they stood behind a silver tea service. And the caption that was put under it said, crabs steamed in their own juices. What more could you want out of life than to read a thing like this? Well, to move us on to the final category then, you must realize, of course, that I had not gotten married, and it was upsetting my family terribly. My father wouldn't say much, but he would put a chair up against the wall and then sit and hit his head on the wall. My grandmother was less subtle than that. She would just scream when I came into the room. That just meant I was single. But I had waited too long. There were no men left. Because in those days, they didn't recycle men the way they do now. They were gone. Well, I happened to be reading a magazine at the dentist's office, and in it, there was an article that could have been written just to me. It said, "Do you want to meet eligible single men? Go out to your local university and take an evening class. In this way, you will meet men of some intellect, men who are interested in the same subject you are, and men who are obviously free in the evening." I thought, well, you know, that's wonderful advice. So I hurried on out to the local university, and I looked through the catalog, and I found something that I had always wanted to learn, because I love languages. That's the first place I looked, beginning Russian. I thought, Russian, we're in the middle of the Cold War. We should all be learning Russian, especially in a strategic naval base location such as the Norfolk where I lived. I said, think of it, the spies that are in Norfolk. Every garage mechanic must be a Russian spy. This is a language whose time has come. And so I went in and signed up for the Russian class, evening class. I went in. Here were 13 men and 2 women, a perfect ratio. The men were all retired military commanders, waiting mysteriously until retirement to learn the language of the enemy. In any case, I thought, well, that's okay. That's okay. This will be fun. And the girls, of course, were there for the same reason I was. They had read the article, too, you see. And now that I remember it, you know what that article was in? Do you know those magazines you see at the checkout counter? And they say things like, lose 20 pounds by Christmas, and then here are 10 fudge cake recipes. I promise you, if you go look, you'll see something like that. Now, in any case, there we were sitting in the class, and I sat next to a girl named Shirley. Now, Shirley said, I heard the professor is single. I said, single? He came into the room just then. I said, this man is not married? I said, he's older than we are. I can tell that. Why isn't he married? She said, I don't know. I said, maybe there's something the matter with him. I said, let's watch how he holds the chalk. We tried to assess the reasons why this man was still single and couldn't quite figure it out. And suddenly he solved the problem himself. He stood up in front of the class and he said, I am now out finally from graduate school. I left Soviet Union. I have bachelor's and master's degrees. This is my first job, and I am free to look for wife. When he said that, Shirley crossed her legs in the most unusual way I had ever seen. I thought, I've got to watch out for Shirley, and I've got to think of something that will move me ahead of Shirley in this. And all of a sudden, I thought of something. I thought, this man is as good as mine. I'm Greek, he's Russian. This means we have the same Easter. Keep her away from him until Lent, and I've got him. And so I bided my time, and as Lent began, I went up to him, and I invited him to Greek Easter dinner at my grandmother's house. And I knew he would be pleased, and he was a lonesome man, and besides, he knew the Russian Orthodox background, and I thought, this is perfect. He came to my grandmother's house. He had a wonderful time. You know, he ate all the food. He made people laugh. He played his balalaika for us. He cracked eggs with the best of us. I waited for the next week to see when he would call. Not a word out of him. I thought something went wrong. Well, later I realized what it was. We had scared him. He was one Russian. We were 35 Greeks. And you know, when Russians eat by themselves, and he had been eating by himself for years, they eat in silence. Well, naturally, if you're alone, you do eat in silence. But even at a dinner table with others present, he was so used to eating in silence that he would go through his meal and then talk to us. Well, the Greeks were appalled because in my grandmother's house, we talk through the food while we eat, spitting. And I thought that might be what scared him off, all of us talking while we ate. And I thought, well, that's okay then. I won't invite him to any more family events, but I will make an A in his course that he'll never be able to ignore. And I worked like anything, and when those grades came out in May, I had a 97 average. And I waited for his call, and he still didn't call. I thought, well, forget him then. I can take something else in September. I'll take industrial arts or something. Well, the summer rolled by. And in the end of August, my phone rang. It was the Russian professor. He remembered my name. I hadn't even expected that. He said, can you come to dinner Tuesday night? I said, yes. He said, can you cook? He said, I have a chicken. And he hung up. I was afraid the chicken would be alive. Yeah. I was afraid he would say, real woman can wring chicken's neck and pluck feathers. But, you know, I accepted. And then I went to my father and my mother and I said, Daddy, Mama, because I was living at home, I said, I'm not going to be here for dinner Tuesday night. I'm going to the Russian teacher's apartment for dinner. And my father said, to his apartment. And so I said, yes. And my father turned to my mother. He said, how old is Hope now? My mother said, 29. He said, go ahead. Well, I went to the Russian teacher's apartment. He met me at the door. He said, chicken is in kitchen. I went out. Thank heaven the chicken was dead. And I said, what do you have? And he found a lemon for me and some salt and pepper. Next thing you know, the chicken was broiling in his little stove. And I found a lettuce and I cut it up to make a salad. He watched me for a little while. He was pleased. He said, well, maybe while you cook, I can go correct a few papers. And I said, well, go right ahead. That's fine. So he went. And when the meal was ready, I called him in. We sat down and in dead silence, Russian style, ate the entire chicken. Because we couldn't think of anything to talk about. We were embarrassed by this. And when the meal was over, I looked at my watch. Do you know it was already 6:15? So I said, well, I guess I should be running along. He said, no, no, let us look at television. We sat in front of the TV. Now, the evening news came on, and at that moment, he turned to me. He said, how old is your grandmother? I said, 92. Why? He said, she needs great-grandchild. Let's get married. I said, are you crazy? I said, what? I said, I cooked a chicken. That's all I've done. I said, I mean, is this sufficient reason for us to spend the rest of our lives together? He said, well, I'll give you a couple more reasons. We both want to get married, and we're both old. I said, well, that's true. I said, but this is a bad proposal. You haven't told me you love me. He said, I don't love you. I barely know you. So I accepted. Listen, I figured it can never get worse than this. I would never be able to say someday, you used to be so romantic, and now look at you scratching and spitting and looking at television. And so we were married, and I'm trying to keep in time. You can wave to me when you want to. She's sitting on her hands. We then had 3 children within 6 years, wasting no time, because our combined ages, of course, were 150, so we had to hurry up. Then we had to learn how to take care of children. And this was a revelation to us, because most of our friends who were our ages already had teenagers. So we acted more like grandparents than parents. We would say, "Isn't he cute setting fire to those curtains?" You know, things like that. But one of our favorite stories in retrospect was of the time we were invited to go out. Now, you don't have any idea how important this became, because for all these years that we were having these children, we didn't go any place at night. And mainly it was because we didn't want to pay a babysitter, nor did we want to go, because we had gone out at night for all those years on dates, looking for husbands and wives. And now we didn't have to do this anymore. It was wonderful not to have to go out at night. Toward the end of the 4th year, I said to him, "Honey, maybe we could go someplace one evening." He said, "Go where, honey? We went last year to the delivery room." I said, "No, a new place." He said, "It costs money to go out." I said, I know. I said, "But you know," I said, "my mother could come and babysit, and suppose somebody invites us." He said, "Nobody ever invites us." I said, "Well, maybe somebody will, and then my mother will come sit. It won't cost us a cent," because we were poor, struggling professor and wife. Well, here came the phone call within the next 3 weeks. An interior decorator I had once met called up. He said, "We didn't realize the two of you were back in town. Listen, we have a gourmet group. We're meeting Wednesday night at Angie's house." I knew Angie's house. That was quite a beautiful place. He said, "It's black tie. We're having the chefs come out from the Omni International Hotel to do us a 10-course French meal, and we're having vintage French wines. Can you join us?" I said, "Well, how much?" He said, "Oh, no, no, we want you as guests." I said, "We'll be there even if we crawl over broken glass." I said to him, "We're going to this." I called my mother. For the first time in her life, she couldn't babysit that night. So, for the first time in the lives of the children, we called a teenage babysitter, something that had never happened before. Now, as we dressed for the gourmet dinner, now, mind you, we had not told the children what was going to happen, because even though we were bigger than they were, we were afraid to tell them. And as we dressed for the dinner, and I was putting on long earrings, and he was shaving in the little bathroom, the children came, and they stood in a little semicircle to watch something they had never seen before. And then the oldest child asked the first question in a tone that clearly indicates disaster is coming. She said, "Where you gonna go?" Now, when she hit the word "go," I knocked over a bottle of Joy perfume. And I straightened it up. He cut himself shaving. I said, "Children, we're just going to run down the street." "Mm-mm." I said, "No, really, we are." I said, "Mm-mm. You're going to go to some funny place." I said, "No, no, we're not." Well, before I could finish, they began to cry in that same way. Ah! And as they got up to the high note of the scream, I looked out the window and a police car was slowing down outside the house. Now the children were in total control. They knew what to do next. They began to gag and hold their breaths as they cried. Ah-ha! And when they drew the breath, we were wrecks. And so we started down the stairs, and the children purposely fell down the steps, attempting suicide. At that moment, the babysitter came in, and my son got sick, and she said, "Are they all right?" I said, "Yeah, they're fine, Virginia." And I thought, hope, use humor. I said, kids, guess what? When we get to this house where we're going, I'm going to call you up." "I don't care." I said, "I'm not finished yet. I'm going to call you up and talk spooky on the phone." They got quiet. "How are you going to talk spooky on the phone?" I said, "I can't do it here. I can only do it over the phone. You wait till you hear it." And while they mulled it over in their little minds, we ran like mad people into the yard. We jumped in the car. We drove in reverse for a block and a half. And then we set off down the expressway to the gourmet dinner. Now, for 20 miles, not one word passed between us. We just drove, looking straight ahead. And then as we pulled into the driveway of the dinner, and there was a full moon, I realized that the romance of the evening had finally come over him. He turned to me, and he said, "Do you think the children are all right?" I said, "Well, how do I know?" And in this mood, we went into the gourmet dinner. And sure enough, a butler had been hired to pass around the rare champagne. And I took a glass, gulped it down in one gulp. And then I said, "Where's your telephone, please?" "In that room, madam." I went into a beautiful little room. It was full of antiques and paintings. There was only one other person in there, a guest I had heard about but never met, a cultural leader of the state, beautifully gowned, sipping a little glass of wine. And she was examining a painting, and she said, "Good evening." And I said, "Well, hi." And then I dialed home. Now, the babysitter was supposed to answer the phone, but for some reason, the oldest child picked up, and she said, "Hello." I said, "Penny, honey, this is Mama." She said, "Talk spooky." So I looked over at this elegant woman. She was examining the painting still and just taking a sip of her wine. I said, "Penny?" That woman spat the whole glass of wine into the painting. And she had a coughing fit that lasted 6 minutes. On that evening, we realized that our lifestyle had changed irrevocably. I regret to say my time is up, and I have only time for one thing, and that is, I never tell jokes usually. I only tell funny stories, but this joke is something that appealed to our family for many years, and it was my husband's favorite joke because it had to do with immigrants, of which he was one, and of Greek immigrants, of which my family had been. A Greek came to this country around 1902, and when he got off the ship, he said to some other Greeks he met there, "I don't want to have a restaurant." They said, "No, Gus, come on now. Greeks always have restaurants." He said, no, "I want to be a cowboy." They couldn't believe it. They said, "No, Greeks is not cowboys." Well, they tried to dissuade him from this insane idea, but somehow he managed to get out to the Dakota Territories, and he became a cowboy. And he had a big hat and ropes and spurs and a big horse, and he was happy. And one day he was galloping along the range, humming and looking at tumbleweeds going by, and suddenly he heard behind him, "Woo, woo, 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 woo." Here came a full tribe of Sioux Indians right behind him, shooting arrows. The Greek had forgotten that this could happen. He went faster and faster. They were right behind him. And finally, the Indian chief reached the Greek, and they galloped side by side. And suddenly, the Indian leaned over and pushed the Greek off of his horse, and the Greek hit the ground. And the Indian got off his horse and stood over the Greek with a tomahawk. Well, the Greek thought, "This is it. My time has come." And he remembered prayers from his village church. He looked up to heaven. He said, "Thee mu panagia mu sosime." And the Indian dropped the tomahawk and said, "You Greek too." And on that note, thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Utihaly Lecture Series. We've heard a talk by nationally acclaimed humorist Hope Mialup. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Monday morning, May 12, 2003, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Keith Christie for his help in the recording of this program. Special thanks also to Jerry Ann Cowan, Publicity Chairman for the Utihaly Lecture Series, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Audio cassette and CD copies are available for $15. Send a check or money order to Utihaly Girls Village, care of Tracy Wells, 3017 Mormon Street, Omaha, Nebraska, 68112-2205. All proceeds from the sale of tapes and CDs will go to benefit the Utihaly Girls Village. Please allow 2 to 3 weeks for delivery. The next lecture in the series will be Monday morning, October 20th at 11 o'clock. The guest speaker will be Academy Award-winning actress and singer, star of The Music Man and Oklahoma, Shirley Jones. If you'd like to attend this or other lectures in the series, call the Utihalee Girls Village at 453-0803. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.